Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Kate Young.
You know, to me, seeds are the most valuable thing that you can possess.
On today's show, we talk with the mother and daughter team of Chankaluta Gardens, growing, saving, and selling indigenous seeds. We learn about the expanding organic farming industry, and we join Chef Arlen Llewellyn in the kitchen for a warming yellow Thai curry soup. That's all coming up on Earth Eats, so stay tuned. First, let's go to the news with Mark Chilla.
Thanks, Kate. The UN Department of Agriculture's latest report on domestic hunger shows levels of food insecurity stayed about the same from 2015 to 2016, with 41.2 million Americans suffering from hunger at some point in the year. That number includes 17 million children. The USDA defines food insecure households as uncertain of having or unable to acquire enough food to meet the needs of all their members because they had insufficient money or other resources for food. Hunger levels have declined overall since peaking at 14.9% in 2011. The yearly report shows hunger levels among Black and Hispanic households are much higher than the national average. In 2016, African American hunger levels were 22.5%, with Hispanic levels at 18.5%. The U.S. Department of Agriculture will have to find a new nominee for its chief scientist role. Harvest Public Media's Erica Hunzinger explains that's because Sam Clovis withdrew his nomination on Thursday in the wake of the federal investigation into the 2016 presidential election.
Clovis ran President Trump's campaign in Iowa last year before becoming the USDA's senior advisor to the White House and the nominee for the head scientist job. But earlier this week, it was revealed that Clovis had encouraged a Trump advisor to meet with Russian officials during the election. That advisor has pleaded guilty to lying to federal agents about his contact with a professor who has ties to the Russian government. Clovis was supposed to have a Senate confirmation hearing next week, but the White House says Clovis told Trump in a letter that he didn't think he'd get a fair hearing and, quote, does not want to be a distraction. Thousands of scientists had opposed Clovis's nomination because he does not have a science background and is a self-described climate change skeptic. Erica Hunzinger, Harvest Public Media.
And Americans are confused about key components of regional and global food systems, what's in the food that they eat, and whether or not it contains genes. That's according to a recent Michigan State University poll of 1,000 Americans ages 18 and over that yielded some surprising results. When asked if non-GMO foods still had genes, 37% said they did not. To be clear, all foods have genes. Other interesting findings include 38% of people ranked their knowledge of food systems as higher than the average person, but 48% said they rarely or never seek information about where their food comes from or how it's produced. That's all I've got for today, Kate. Thanks to Erica Hunzinger from Harvest Public Media, as well as Chad Bouchard and Taylor Killow for these stories.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
Yep, not a problem, Kate.
Organic food is a $40 billion industry and growing. That has the attention of some farmers discouraged by years of low prices for their conventional crops. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach has the story of a Nebraska farm making the switch to tap into the lucrative organic market.
A couple years ago, Berkey Farms started talking about the future, not only how they farm, but also how they're going to make money. The issue was conventional corn and soybeans, which were and still are selling at prices where farmers are just hoping to break even, and it didn't look like that would change.
So we're looking at years of maybe making money, maybe not.
Eric Thalkin had just moved back to southeast Nebraska with his wife to be closer to her extended family, the Berkeys. They looked at moving into a riverside cabin on a piece of family land. Thalkin didn't like the cabin, but the hayfield next to it caught his eye. We got in his truck to go see it.
The field was alfalfa, and it was honestly pretty weedy. And so it gave me the idea that this could be certified organic right away. And it looked like fun and money.
That's when the conversation changed. Thalkin started working for Berkey Farms and convinced them to switch that weedy alfalfa field to organic. Today, it's covered with rows of corn stalks rattling in the breeze.
So this is certified organic.
Thalkin pulls back the husks on a few ears like he's unwrapping a Christmas present.
That's a good ear of corn there. Free of any ear rots, bugs, anything like that.
After trying out one field, Berkey Farms is now switching the whole farm to organic. And it's a lot of land, 2,400 acres. It takes 3 years to be certified as an organic farm, 3 years with no genetically modified seed, no synthetic pesticides or fertilizer, but there is a significant payoff. That corn?
Some of it is sold at $8.80, some of it sold at $9.
And if it were a conventional crop this year?
Depending on how you market it, $3 to maybe $3.50.
So more than double?
Close to triple.
Those type of numbers perks the interest of farmers. Money talks.
Greg Lichtai oversees purchasing of organic grain for Schooler, a grain marketing company based in Omaha, Nebraska.
We see more farmers considering becoming certified organic.
There were 5 million acres of organic fields and pastures in the U.S. in 2016, according to the Department of Agriculture. That's still a small percentage of farmland overall, but places like Colorado, Iowa, Minnesota, and Texas have all seen a jump in organic acres. Lichtai says demand is growing in the organic sector, in large part from organic dairy and poultry farms that need organic corn and soybeans for animal feed. Production of those crops went up 30% in the U.S. just last year. But it's not enough. Half of the organic corn and three-quarters of the organic soybeans used across the country are actually imported.
So, yeah, there's a shortage in that this country is importing to meet the demand.
Sounds like an opportunity, but switching to organic is not so easy as ditching GMO seed and putting away the herbicide. Farmers have to buy new machinery like cultivators and rotary hoes to stir up weeds out of the soil. And you can't just grow corn and soybeans, so you have to learn to grow things like oats or clover. Craig Chase of Iowa State University takes questions from farmers considering going organic. But many of them view it as too big a change, Chase says, especially since the average farmer is in their late 50s.
And they're going to say, I may only have 5 to 10 years left growing crops at all. And the question is, do I want to go ahead and invest in a new system?
And Eric Thalkin says even though organic grain prices are higher, the margin for error is smaller. Let's say a farmer's late with the cultivator. Weeds can get out of control, and there are no herbicides to help out.
To pull off a good organic crop, you have to be good on every single step through the way. If someone didn't set a cultivator right, or if you got the wrong cover crop mix, you could literally cut your yields in half.
It's a risk, but with the farm economy in the doldrums, it's one that more farmers are willing to take. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Visit harvestpublicmedia.org for more stories about agriculture in the heartland. Production support comes from Needmore Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. NeedmoreRoasters.com. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. It's soup weather in southern Indiana, folks, and time for the Bloomington Farmers Market's annual soup tasting. It's a chance for area chefs to join with local farmers to celebrate the abundance of the fall harvest and show off some great recipes. We join Chef Arlen Llewellyn of Function Brewing as she prepares her offering for the event. She's making a Thai yellow curry vegetable soup and lots of it.
I'm making 10 to 15 gallons because 5 gallons will go to the market and 5 to 10 gallons we'll serve here at the restaurant the same week. The first year we did the soup tasting, we didn't have the same soup on. Like, I just made a soup to take the tasting, and then we had a different one at the restaurant. And people were, like, kind of frustrated or confused by that because they thought they were tasting something they could then go to our restaurant and eat that day. So And we're going to make our own curry paste. So the cheater version of this is that you absolutely could buy your own yellow curry paste.
But we're going to go from scratch all the way.
Yes, absolutely. So we are going to start in our food processor. So the recipe is written for serrano chilies, which are typically easy to find at the grocery store. You can use jalapenos. But I'm actually, in this particular case, going to use a mix of peppers that I've received from the chili woman. These are some Aji Pancas and Bolivian chilies that we will also mix up with some jalapenos. So we want to do just kind of a rough chop on these. We come along with a medium shallot. Just going to do a rough chop on that. So a really rough chop on some garlic cloves. Now we're going to get to one of my favorite ingredients, galangal. It's sort of like a fruitier version of ginger, maybe. It's so bright and fresh smelling. I love it combined with ginger. It's kind of an ugly little knobby looking thing. So just like ginger, it's kind of tough. So we want to break it down into relatively small pieces before we put it in the food processor. And then we're going to get to a little ginger. I'm going to peel that as well. We are moving on to lemongrass. And it typically starts with a stalk that's about 2 feet long, 3/4 of an inch in diameter. The first thing you want to do is cut off the very bottom, and then you cut it in half, and you peel off the tough outer leaves as well as the top half of the stalk. And you're left with the tender inner core. So we'll break down the lemongrass as much as we possibly can to try to help the food processor with that. And then some cilantro. So we're going to go ahead and put these things into the food processor and let the food processor do the work for us. Man, take a whiff of that. It's lots of bright flavors that you could take quite a few minutes to break apart. You can definitely smell the ginger and the galangal and the lemongrass. A little bit of cilantro still. A little bit of heat released from those peppers. And so far right now, it's actually kind of looking more like you were making a green curry. That's about to change because we're going to add a few spices. So we want a half a teaspoon of coriander. Tablespoon of turmeric, which is going to get you the bright yellow. We want half a tablespoon of curry powder. So we're just going to process this for a second to get, we've scraped down the sides, and then we're going to process this for a second to incorporate those spices. Now we have our curry paste. So again, at this stage, maybe you've skipped this and you're just opening a can of yellow curry paste. And now we're going to proceed. We're going to get that cooking. To that, we're going to add 3 tablespoons of neutral cooking oil of your choice. I'm gonna get this going over medium to high heat for just a few minutes. You want it to start to become extremely aromatic and start to caramelize a little bit in a few of the areas of the pot.
Llewellyn prepares the vegetables. 1 medium butternut squash, peeled, seeded, and cubed. Chef Llewellyn cautions against throwing all the vegetables into a pot and cooking the soup for hours and hours. One of the advantages of making homemade soups is that you can maintain some of the different textures of the vegetables.
In this case, we're not going to put all the vegetables all in at the same time. Different vegetables are going to take different amounts of time to cook to a desirable texture inside of a soup. So we're going to start with the vegetables that need to take the most time to break down and be soft, and get those going first, and then we'll slowly add some more. And once we start adding those more delicate vegetables at the end that don't need to cook for very long, we're going to take that soup off the heat pretty quickly.
Chef Llewellyn separates Swiss chard and kale leaves from their stalks. She chops the stalks into half-inch pieces, chops the leaves into bite-sized pieces, and sets those aside. She then adds the chopped stalks and the butternut cubes to the simmering curry paste on the stove. Next, she pours in 4 cups of water, or enough to cover the vegetables in the pot.
And we're going to cook it for about 30 minutes. It depends really on the size of your vegetables, but you want them to start getting tender, not completely tender, because we are going to add more vegetables to it.
The last vegetable to prep is the sweet pepper, seeded and thinly sliced.
This has been cooking for about 30 minutes, and the butternut squash is starting to get tender. The stalks of greens are starting to get tender. Nice thing about greens is they always look like you're never going to fit them all in the pot. And they cook down so much, it isn't usually a problem. So you can see the hot liquid is already immediately wilting the greens.
Oh, this smells so good.
Good, yes.
I mean, you're getting all that curry, but also now the fresh vegetables.
So, now that our peppers and greens are in here, we're gonna cook them for about 10 more minutes. Don't wanna overcook at this stage, but you don't necessarily wanna be munching on raw peppers either. So we have a Thai yellow curry vegetable soup that we've pulled. We've basically added all the vegetable stew and they've cooked. Those peppers and greens have softened and we're ready to just finish this up. So we're gonna add coconut milk. So one of the nice things about Thai curries in general is a explosion of flavors that hit your mouth. You get spiciness, you get sourness, you get sweetness right off the bat. And depending on some of the other ingredients, you might also get some funky, complex notes, some bitter elements, depending on the vegetables you use. So in this case, we're definitely going for sweet, sour, salty, and spicy. And so we've got our sweet coming in right now with some brown sugar. We already have our spiciness from the hot peppers that we put into the curry paste. We're definitely gonna need some salt and some acidity. So we're gonna add 4 tablespoons of white vinegar and some sea salt to taste. And then we get to do the best part, which is taste and adjust. Sweetness is coming through. There's definitely some spice. And I'm gonna wanna add a little bit more vinegar and a little bit more salt. I was conservative on both of those initially because it's really hard to undo that. Garnish it with whatever you fancy. Toasted coconut, Thai basil, toasted cashews, rice noodles. We're here on a Monday making a soup for the Saturday tasting by design, because whenever possible, it's always better to make soups in advance because the flavors will really develop and marry. It's important sometimes, I think, to, if you're making something in advance and you don't think you like it, but it's kind of close to what you want, but you're not sure, don't do anything else to it. Let it sit for a couple days. You may actually love it exactly where it is once it's had time to hang out and mature. So
the finished soup is a burst of color and flavor.
You get contrasting textures from the different vegetables. The butternut squash is quite soft at this point, but you still get some chew from the peppers and the greens.
Yeah, the flavors are so complex and the tanginess, like I was a little nervous when I saw that vinegar going in, but it's just so perfectly balanced with that sweet and all the spicy.
You don't have to take our word for it. This soup is available for tasting at the Bloomington Community Farmers Market from 10:30 to 12:30 this Saturday. If you want to give this soup a try for yourself at home, we've got the recipe on our website, eartheats.org. If you're visiting the farmers market this Saturday, you might also stop by the Chonkaluta Gardens booth. Angela Kane and her mother Paula Cook sell a variety of indigenous seeds at the Bloomington Farmers Market. Proceeds go to support gardening efforts at the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. I spoke with them at the market earlier this fall.
So how's it going today? You getting a lot of customers?
Yeah, we're getting a fair amount of customers.
What are some of your best sellers?
Probably consistently arugula has been a bestseller. I'm not sure why. Maybe it's just harder to find. The Cherokee Trail of Tear beans, our Hadatsa beans as well are pretty good sellers. But arugula, for some reason, has been killing it recently.
Let's see what kind of lettuces they have. Arugula, buttercrunch lettuce, Grand Rapids lettuce, oak leaf lettuce. Got several kinds of kale, lacinato, blue curled Scotch kale, Russian red or ragged jack kale. Angela said that you were selling a lot of arugula, and that makes sense because you can still plant that this year.
Right. We're selling a lot of the fall crops. People also are buying some of the flowers and things that they can put out after the last frost and over winter.
I spoke with one of their regular customers, Gary Verosco. He says he's bought plenty of seeds from Chonkaluta.
And I also bought plants from them.
What kind of plants did you get?
Squash plants, 6 different kinds, and bean plants, 6 different varieties of beans. All of her greens and collards. I got some. Do you have radishes? I got radishes. Probably a few other things also that I've forgotten. I got them last spring.
How have your plants done?
Very well. And germination has been very high. But I'm collecting dried beans right now. Since I bought 6 kinds of varieties of beans, I'm going to collect them all, dry them, and then have mixed beans, pots of mixed beans over the winter.
Oh, great. So you're drying your seeds not to save the seed to plant next year. You're drying to eat.
Both.
That's great. It sounds like a good, you're going to make like a soup or something?
Exactly. Potatoes, carrots, onions, garlic, celery, maybe a little bit of sausage once in a while when I cook them. And I don't do the cooking, my wife does.
Okay.
I procure for her and grow for her.
Mitchell Toplitsky, Communications Director at the Language Conservancy, sat down in our studio with the founders of Chonkaluta Gardens, Angela Kane and her mother, Paula Cook. The name of the organization, Chonkaluta, is a Lakota term meaning red road and refers to native ways and traditions. The first iteration of the organization was run by Kane's parents, Paula Cook and Kenneth Kane. Angela Kane spent her early years traveling around to benefits and speaking engagements as her father, the dynamic leader of the organization, raised money for the Lakota tribe and the people living at Pine Ridge in South Dakota.
It was just a whole lot of food drives, asking for food, benefits. Buskirk Chumley, I remember being probably no older than 5 or 6 and selling tickets for, you know, some of the benefits and everything. So it was just a whole lot of that. It was a whole lot of benefits and food drives and just a lot of people working together. And then he also spread the word with, you know, a lot of seminars, places here and there, at schools, and basically anywhere he could to spread the word and get donations out there. I knew that I wanted to carry on Chonkaluta, but I really just did not like the handout, let's beg for money, let's, you know, that sort of thing. So
Paula Cook describes a gardening movement happening at Pine Ridge.
Now, down in Pine Ridge, they started organic gardening, and now they have, in the last 15 years, something like 500 family organic gardens now. And it's a big revolution because everybody's excited about this now, and they're doing seminars, and it's a very exciting time.
Mitchell Toplitsky asked about the catalyst for that movement.
A Mohawk guy who married a Lakota woman was a big gardener, Tom Cook. He's not related that I know of. And then Milo Yellowhair, our good friend Milo Yellowhair, they started getting grants. They started getting a tractor and tillers, and they just started going out, and they put in a greenhouse and with plants, and they just started putting in gardens.
Going along with Milo Yellowhair's gardens, we were thinking, you know, what can we do to make money as well as, you know, help people out? We just kind of came up with seeds. Because, you know, if we had any extra, of course, it can go out there. And then we thought, okay, let's do some indigenous seeds and roll with the theme of, you know, Cherokee Trail of Tear beans. And yeah, just selling them, you know, for profit to send out there.
And where do you get the seeds?
We grow them all ourselves between my garden and my mom's garden. They all come from us. I think we started out with maybe 7 different varieties of seeds, and I think we're over, I want to say maybe 150
or probably closer to 200, yes.
I asked Cook how growing for seed is different than growing to eat the produce.
It is different. For instance, what you really want to do when you save the seeds is you want them to be able to dry on the plants. That's the best solution. Sometimes maybe something has to come in, whether it's flower heads or beans or your winter squashes and things. You want them to really dry, you know, have the stems drying. So things like beans, for instance, where you want to pick the beans to keep them producing heavily. If you don't pick them, then they'll quit producing. So we do things like with beans, like we go ahead and pick them for a while, and then we stop. And then they'll keep continuing on. But yeah, you do need to keep them on the plants, if at all possible, pretty much all the way around, you know, even corn or anything. You want to try to let things dry as much as possible.
I asked Angela what had surprised her most since starting Chonkaluta Gardens.
I guess this wasn't really a surprise as much, just because Bloomington is very open-minded, but maybe just the support, I think, and everyone being so knowing what these seeds are and asking if we have this variety or that variety, and you know, and we're like, oh, we never really thought of that. So I think that just the overwhelming support and what people know about indigenous plants, I think that was the most surprising thing to me.
Paula Cook concluded our conversation with one final remark.
You know, to me, seeds are the most valuable thing that you can possess.
You can find a link to Chonkaluta Gardens' website on our website. That's eartheats.org. You can visit the Chonkaluta Gardens booth at the Farmers Market this Saturday. Production support comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personal financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, Farm Bloomington Restaurant, Harvest Public Media, and Indiana University Food Institute. Special thanks this week to Mitchell Toplitsky. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young, and that's our show.